back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city.
Downtown, things will be great when you're downtown. No final place for sure. Downtown, everything's waiting for you.
Said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doo 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 doo.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren. And welcome to the Rants Macabre. Today's episode is about New York horror. And I've had a tough time writing about what sets New York aside from other cities. I've lived in a few places, but I couldn't really say why I'm stuck on New York. God knows it's not an easy city to live in. Plenty of people straight up hate it. The rent is high, the quality of life is eh, and feeling safe changes on a block-by-block basis. That said, once you're tempered to it, New York can spoil you for other cities. With some of the greatest art and culture in the world, undoubtedly some of the best food at practically any hour, the hours themselves are different. There's never going to be enough time to do and see it all. The New York minute is no joke. That's why when New Yorkers go to other cities, everything feels like it's moving in slow motion. We're wound tight and we move fast. If you're an anxious person, it can all be too much. The buildings themselves, not being able to see the sky, can have a real impact, especially if you're claustrophobic. There are a lot of places to hide, and that's in the daytime. So with 8.5 million people living in its 5 boroughs, you're never going to run out of stories to tell. The movies and stories we're going to focus on today aren't true stories, but they are most certainly art imitating life.
And they could be true.
So, Mindy, I was going to ask you, you came to New York after college in search of fortune and glory, I presume. I wanted to ask you about that experience coming from the Midwest.
Yeah, well, I came here, we graduated from college, and then I moved with my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, and some friends of ours from college, and we worked summer jobs that summer after college to just have enough money to come here.
Okay.
So I moved to New York with $5,000. That's all I had. I didn't have a job. I didn't have anything. My friend came on like a layover and found an apartment in about 3 or 4 hours for us.
Wow.
And then went back. It was all on a layover. That's how we got our first apartment. And then he said, we're going to be living in this place. And I said, okay, fine. Because I joined the guys a month later when I showed up.
Oh, okay.
Because I had some things I had to do. So, yeah, moving here is really wild because I think the hours are completely different. And that's absolutely true. It's nothing. I mean, when I'm working 9 to 5, I still don't go to bed until after midnight.
Really? Still?
Yeah, still. I got things to do, and there's all this time I feel to do it in.
Movies to watch.
I do have a lot of horror movies to watch. No, so it's nothing to start, you know, a movie at 11 o'clock.
Mm.
That's an average thing. You know, we eat later.
Yeah, yeah. We're like Spaniards.
Exactly. No, it's a very different place. It's a different city, and I think seeing people come and go, you know, friends who've come out to move out here.
Yeah.
You have like 6 months. And if you haven't hit that learning curve, it's a fast learning curve.
Yeah.
And if you haven't figured it out in 6 months, you go home, and they do. And that's what they do. And then if you've made it past 6 months, you can probably deal with it.
Let me ask you, what kept you here?
I know how it works. I know the city.
Yeah.
I know how business works here. I know how people
work. You seem to have taken to it pretty well. Frankly, I think if I were to meet you today, I would think you might have grown up in Manhattan.
I do love Manhattan.
Yeah. So when you first moved to New York, you moved to the infamous Roosevelt Island.
Right. But at the time, I didn't know it was infamous. I thought, this is crazy. There's this island that's not Manhattan. It's not Queens.
Beautiful views.
It's beautiful.
Breezy on the river.
Wait, it's not beautiful there. The views are beautiful. Yes, you're right. It's breezy. It's like about 10 degrees colder, I think, than Manhattan or Queens, just because it's sitting dead in the middle of the East River. There's a bridge that runs over. There's a tram. Who doesn't want to ride on a tram every
day? Everybody's seen the tram in the movie. It looks like the greatest fun ever.
Yeah, it's not, but but at first it seems that way. So yeah, that's where we moved. That's where my friend had found the apartment. And I will tell you, it's probably the nicest apartment I'll ever live in my life. Because for the price, Roosevelt Island, you get what you pay for there. But you get a beautiful apartment, you just live on Roosevelt Island.
Okay, so we're going to dig in a little bit with Roosevelt Island because it is a unique setting for a horror movie. In this case,
it's horror in real life at Roosevelt Island.
In this case, the movie is Dark Water, and I guess it was a remake of a Japanese film by the same name, this time directed by Walter Sales, who made The Motorcycle Diaries, and it stars Jennifer Connelly from Labyrinth, Requiem for a Dream, and all this stuff. Tim Roth, he's almost unrecognizable.
Right.
And John C. Reilly, who plays the perfect scumbag real estate agent. So it takes place on Roosevelt Island, similarly in terms of like going out there for the cheap rent. And then, of course, things start falling apart.
Yeah, she acts like it's like nice schools and a nice family place to live, though. And that's how it's sold to her. Like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, this is
yeah.
A fun family place.
With a great school. They keep pushing the great school.
Mommy, that's not the city.
Sure, it's just a different part of the city.
No, that's the city over there. That's not the city.
She's right.
Mm-hmm. So Dark Water uses Roosevelt Island, but for all the great visuals, and in this case, the movie, it's gorgeously shot. It seems to have used every single rainy day in 2004 to film. It's as if like New York is Seattle, and it never stops raining. But that said, like for all the eerie elements of Roosevelt Island, they don't actually use any of the history
stuff. Right, which is terrifying. And there doesn't need to be some Japanese ghost. Well, she's Russian in this one. Russian ghost in the freaking water supply. Like Roosevelt Island is scary enough on its own.
Yeah.
And it's got this like terrifying history, which is really awesome, which we always talk about maybe going at Halloween time to sneak into the smallpox hospital, which is the big thing about Roosevelt Island, is the abandoned smallpox hospital. But better than smallpox are the asylums that were originally on Roosevelt Island.
Okay, but not anymore?
No, they're not anymore.
These days they're probably condos.
Well, exactly. Well, the Octagon, we'll get into that. Since you asked, Darren. No, and what I liked about it, the asylums in the mid to late 1800s, especially on the East Coast, it's all like bedlam style.
Yeah.
And they called them lunatic asylums, which I love. I think
that's
it's really
considerate.
Exactly. I think it's like really classy. You know, classes up the joint. So like in 1839, that's when the first lunatic asylum shows up on Roosevelt Island. And that's what is now today the Octagon, which is a co-op building.
It makes it sound like they made the crazy people fight.
Maybe they did.
Enter the Octagon.
Maybe they did. Octagon actually burnt down twice.
If that's not an omen.
Exactly. And then they've taken the remaining part that didn't burn down and they built these like luxury co-ops around it, which for like $2,500 for a one bedroom, you can live in a luxury building.
Former burnt down mental institution.
Former burnt down lunatic asylum. In the lunatic asylum, it held over 1,700 inmates, which is over twice what it was supposed to.
Yeah, Roosevelt Island's not that big.
No. Even now today, I think there's only about 12,000 people who live on Roosevelt Island. This is one asylum has 1,700 people in it. People were sleeping on the floors. And there was actually, if you remember, the American Horror Story Asylum, where she goes into the asylum.
Yeah.
A woman did that in the late 1800s and wrote about everything she had seen, which became the book 10 Days in a Madhouse.
Wow.
So that was part of that, an original like exploration of bedlam style lunatic asylums. And what was also awesome, lunatic asylums, there was also some prisons going on there, smallpox hospital down in the South End. It was New York's finest. And in the lunatic asylum, they didn't want to pay for orderlies, so they hired the prisoners. Because the prisoners worked for free.
Oh, I was going to ask if they at least got put on payroll. But
no, they worked for free
an extra
with
sandwich
the people
at lunch.
With the lunatic asylum.
Mm-hmm.
So enjoy
that's
that.
That's literally the crazies running the
exactly.
insane asylum.
It was a pretty bad thing. And so the smallpox hospital shows up in the mid-1800s when there's already smallpox treatment. People know how to cure smallpox. It's not really that big of a problem, but they put all the immigrants with smallpox at the smallpox hospital with no intention ever of curing them.
Wow.
Just put them there. Enjoy being there.
How is the movie not about this?
Like, see, that's what I'm saying.
They had to remake a Japanese movie. In the meantime, all this history is right there waiting for
and
them.
And it's terrifying. I will say, like, when I lived there, that's now a ruin. The smallpox hospital is now a ruin.
God.
and the Octagon was just being built when I had moved there. So it wasn't like a thing at the time. But when I lived there, there was one Gristetti's, there was one pizza place, and there was one restaurant.
And I'm sure they all closed at 5.
Everything was dark at nighttime. Because here's the other thing, and it's going to make me sound like an asshole, but it's nothing to walk down the main street of Roosevelt Island, which there's only one main street of Roosevelt Island, and see half a person wheeling around town. It's nothing to see two halves of a person, two different people, not just like the legs walking around on the top.
Two half people
walking around.
So, sorry, so there's still a hospital for the infirmed?
Yeah, well, what is there now is a type of Section 8 for disabilities.
Okay.
There is also a school for children with behavioral issues, which is another. There's just so much going on.
It's still kind of serving that role of maintaining these, like, you know, the unspeakables, kind of like those that society doesn't want to deal with.
I have a friend that calls Roosevelt Island the Island of Misfit Toys.
Because
there's people missing parts. There's people acting up. It's a horrible place. But it's a very scary place. So it's an excellent place, I think, for dark water. You know, like,
I was going to say, comparatively, the horror movie Dark Waters is actually like a lighter look at Roosevelt Island.
It's a place of horrors. I'm not lying.
So, yeah, not to go in too deep because it's frankly not a great movie.
Thank you for saying that because you seemed to like it before you finished it.
I watched the first hour and 20 minutes and I was satisfied that it was a pretty generic ghost story. It actually had some threads in common with The Babadook in terms of, like, struggling mom, trying to keep it together, raising a kid by herself. And then the ghost story really was just paint by numbers. And all the stuff was telegraphed really early in the movie.
Right.
So that it kind of ended slowly. Yeah, I don't know. There are a couple of peculiar things. It is so heavily scored. There's so much music second to second that it does kind of spoil some pretty terrific visuals. Like it is shot beautifully and Roosevelt Island has an air of creepiness, but it's kind of done away with when like every moment is just like da da dun dun dun. No thanks.
No thank you. And you know, the whole thing starts kind of off because the kid wanted that Hello Kitty book bag. She's the one who fucks everyone over, the little kid, because she doesn't like the place at first. Then
yeah,
she sees the book bag, and then she's like, yes, I want to live where the Hello Kitty book bag lives.
Oh, I guess the kid was a driving force. That's an interesting point. The kid actor is pretty good in that way that, like, Haley Joel Osment was in The Sixth Sense, where, like, you are way too mature for your size, like... The actor from Orphan, like, maybe you're just a little person acting as a child.
Exactly.
You're Gary Coleman-esque. but so she's really good, and she kind of, I don't know, lends a certain amount of eeriness to it. But and her counterpart in the movie, I recognized as the little girl who plays Uma Thurman's daughter in Kill Bill. I think her name is Bibi in the movie. It's like playing the face game. I recognized her. So, yeah, I don't know. Dark Water, not great. You could skip it.
But it's a good movie about New York.
I would say skip it and actually maybe do a walking tour of Roosevelt Island if you really want to be. Take the tram and walk around and learn about what's actually creepy about Roosevelt Island.
But don't ask the people of Roosevelt Island because there's like a little like community group and they do their damnedest to take the creepy bad shit out of like the Wikipedia pages, out of
really,
yeah.
Oh,
they're like,
you know
really
what? I bet you that's
it.
Real estate people doing that.
Yeah, they're really.
They're trying
funny
to sell
about it.
Sell the view and only the view.
Uh huh.
Okay, so going from Dark Water to 2008. You know what? I wanted to call it a blockbuster, but I don't remember how well it actually did in the movie theaters.
It's
but
huge.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it seemed like a huge film.
In scope. So we're talking about Cloverfield. And Cloverfield was directed by Matt Reeves and written by Drew Goddard, who are both in the J.J. Abrams camp. Reeves did the remake of Let the Right One In called Let Me In. Mm-hmm. And he recently did the Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which has too many of those for any.
I watched
any...
it though, and I kind of liked it. I like those Planet of the Apes movies. The, fuck you.
Of the apes. and so yeah, so Drew Goddard, we should know for having done the outstanding Cabin in the Woods,
right.
Which yeah, go see that. But yeah, so Cloverfield was sort of a machination of J.J. Abrams.
I want a monster movie. I want a great monster movie. I've wanted a monster movie for so long. And I was in Japan over a year ago with my son, who's 8. And all he wanted to do was go to toy stores. So I know he's my son. And we went to all these stores, and there were still all these Godzillas everywhere. And I thought, what's better than Godzilla? And I thought, you know, we need our own monster. Like, we need a monster movie. And I thought, not like King Kong. I love King Kong. And King Kong's adorable. And and Godzilla is you know, a charming monster. We love Godzilla, but I wanted something that was just insane and intense. And so we started making this movie, and we're making it for you right now.
I loved Cloverfield. Did you watch it when it came out?
Yeah, I actually saw it at lunchtime from here. we ran away and watched an hour and a half movie during our lunch. I loved it. I still love it.
I've
rewatched it for this. Yeah.
I love that movie. I love Lizzie Kaplan.
Oh, yeah.
She's, you know where I get the Timothy Olyphants and all those confused with each other?
Yeah.
She, to me, is like the rich person's Kat Dennings. I love Lizzie Kaplan.
Okay. I got nothing against Kat Dennings. I like them both. But yeah, no, Lizzie Kaplan is really
funny. She's awesome.
And she wasn't huge by this point. So one of the things the movie really does well is cast mostly unknowns, and even those knowns are pretty low on the totem pole. So Lizzie Kaplan, I think up to this point, she had actually been in Mean Girls and Freaks and Geeks for a small part, but she wasn't huge. She wasn't, now she's in Masters of Sex and like every other movie.
Right, she's in everything.
But so most of the actors are unknown, so you're never taken out of it. It is a POV movie that starts with this guy's going away party, and you're just along for the ride when a crab monster starts to eat New York.
Yeah.
Looks like you should have left town earlier.
It really stays true to that idea, and I kind of enjoy the... There is never a scientist who shows up and says, this creature came from outer space,
and it's
here because it wants blah, blah, blah. Like, there's no explanation. You are getting it from the man on the street level, and that man on the street, actually, the guy behind the camera, is T.J. Miller.
Right.
Who's a stand-up comic, is a really, really offbeat, really funny, clever, odd guy. I guess he was in the last Transformers movie. He pops up, he was in the Yogi Bear movie. Like, he does really strange stand-up comedy, but at the same time, like, winds up in Steven Spielberg-produced movies. And so he you only get to see him, I think, maybe twice in the movie, where he turns he receives the camera, and then he turns a camera on himself once while he's cleaning it. But otherwise, you're just hearing him.
Right,
so he's
kind
of playing the narrator, but it's not overdone. I really liked his character. And he's got a crush on Lizzie Kaplan, so, I mean, totally relatable.
Yeah, why wouldn't you? Of course.
So we're going to talk about the subways in more depth, but one of the greatest setups is the escape, and in they're going from downtown to midtown,
which they get there unusually fast. Let's say they walk from Spring Street up to 59th Street in the blink of an eye.
They do. Although, I mean,
because they get up to Columbus Circle, I don't even know what tunnel they're working in right now.
Oh yeah, that's okay. So the movie is mostly shot in New York, and then they use a ton of green screen because it is a fucking monster eating New York.
Sure, we can't have that.
but yeah, so we were saying the scene in the subway tunnels when they're eventually hauling ass.
Yes.
There's a great, and it actually harkens back to 28 Days Later when the flood of rats go by them. I think they figure out, I'm trying to remember the sequence, they do realize that, like, if the rats are fleeing something, it's a lot worse than people.
Right.
So they start running, but T.J. Miller, the main character, turns on the night vision. They used to use that more. The green.
That used to be a big deal.
At which point you see an extra element that is really unique for a giant monster movie, that this thing is so big, when it has lice, those lice are the size of a bicycle.
Which is what I'm always saying about whale lice. Because you know how I want to poke a whale in the eye. That's not a secret. It's just something I want to do with my life.
It's a first for podcast listeners. But
oh, yeah. Sorry. So it is a secret to them now out. But whales have really big lice. And I didn't anticipate like a louse that could take. Louse? I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. That could take off my finger. That's terrifying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So in this case, the lice, we get to see some footage of the military fighting the thing and lice are falling off, bouncing, and then going after the gunman. Actually, that reminds me that there were early talks. It seems to have fallen apart, but there were talks of making a sequel to Cloverfield.
Yes, I remember that.
And it was going to be from the perspective of the military. And I thought that would be really cool. That's a little bit, you know, aliens, compared to the first. But it does seem to have fallen apart. And that's too bad, because the monster in this really was unique. Like, it was seemingly asymmetrical and kind of abstract, but it moved like this gargantuan thing trying to navigate buildings, really clumsily smashing shit all over the place.
I like that. But see, that's the thing is, I would like my monster to be a big clumsy situation that I can keep an eye on. When the shit starts falling off of him, the little monsters, that's what you have to watch out for.
Sure.
That I can't outrun. I'm very slow.
So to go any deeper would be to start giving away spoilers, but if you've got a big screen TV, that's the way you want to see Cloverfield.
Definitely.
It's too bad that, you know, if you haven't seen it already in the theater, that was the way to watch New York. The special effects hold up pretty well, especially the like rooftop stuff later in the movie. The shots of the monster in the context of the city shot from another high rise are outstanding.
Yeah.
It's really fucking creepy and unsettling. Especially if in New York you've ever been to like the top of a tall building or looked out a high window. Cloverfield is a big, big recommend.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. Absolutely. And it's a great New York film because you get a great feel for the city.
The Brooklyn Bridge scene is it's a bummer for anybody who's actually had to evacuate. Were you here in 2003 during the blackout?
No, I came after.
Okay. That was, that sucked.
Yeah. I came in 2005.
Okay. Yeah. For those that don't know, there was a massive East Coast blackout and New York was hit. And at first we were thinking it was terrorism, but it turned out it was just a power failure fuck up during a really hot summer. And so everybody who commutes into the city, which I'll get into later, but it is 5.6 million New Yorkers use the subway every day. Had to evacuate the island on foot. And that sucked. So the Brooklyn Bridge exodus in the movie kind of harkens back to that. And the moment a monster is your roadblock, then double fucked.
Right. Because
really
I remember the train strike, the MTA strike.
Okay.
And I was on my Roosevelt Island tram, because that was when I lived on Roosevelt Island. And I would be on the tram and I would see all the people walking along the bridge, but the tram still ran. So I was like, fuckers. The only like good reason to be on Roosevelt Island. The tram. As far as New York horror goes, to me, it's nothing better than the 1985 Best Fantasy Film in the Brussels International Film Festival than 1984's Chud.
I'm standing in front of what appears to be the scene of a massacre, but so far there has been no official confirmation as to exactly what happened here.
I wanted to hit the drum roll, but Chud. not Chode, Chud. The first of, I think there's three.
The first of many.
The first of many. The franchise leader, Chud.
And now this one I had not even really probably heard of.
Really?
But a listener told me to watch this movie. And so I trusted him. And
it's a cult classic. It absolutely is.
It's an excellent New York film.
I'm having a hard time discerning whether like you're being sarcastic.
No, I'm being sarcastic. But
okay.
For New York,
okay.
It's
well,
great.
I know the Brussels Film Festival
that's
bit.
Not
that's
me.
Authentic.
That's for reals.
Yes.
Best fantasy film.
You wonder what else was nominated that year that lost to Chud.
What is 1984? I don't know, cat people. Maybe. No, that's in the 70s. I don't know what it would be.
Okay, so, well, I will say Chud is an excellent New York movie.
Uh-huh, yes.
It starts with a bang. If you remember, the first thing we see is a woman walking her dog, and up comes the manhole, and out that's comes right. the hand, and whoop, she's done, and so is the dog. And then we find out later she's more significant to the characters in the story.
Chud?
What?
C-H-U-D.
Here, let me see.
Now, give me that. Where do you think you are? High school? That's a classified government file.
Now, what does it stand for?
A cannibalistic humanoid underground dweller. A chud, all right?
And then there's a nice twist that it turns out, not so much. That's not really exactly where that comes from. But, so the movie has a bunch of characters.
Yes.
A lot of even featured protagonists. None of them likable.
No, you hate everybody.
They're all dicks.
Yes.
They're kind of, they're all smug assholes.
Everyone is. Even the women. Like,
the closest you get is Daniel Stern, which I didn't know he was in this, and it was such a pleasant surprise.
Yeah.
But even he is chewing the scenery.
Absolutely.
So small Home Alone reunion later, when John Hurd, who's one of the 17 protagonists, runs into Daniel Stern in the sewers. And so that's kind of, not sewers, yeah, I guess sewers and subways. They seem to interconnect in this story.
Yes. Yeah, apparently it seems like in New York in 1984, you could just hop off a train and walk into the subway.
We literally watch an old woman do that in this character.
So now we know we can do that. Excellent.
I guess, well, we've talked about the mole people, and you're fascinated with the documentary Dark Days
that
went into the tunnels. And in that case, it was like abandoned tunnels off of, I think it was like the Long Island Railroad side.
In the Hudson.
But in this case, the Chuds are preying on the mole people. And the only people who really notice are Daniel Stern, soup kitchen manager fella character.
Right.
And the cop who eventually is brought into the story. But it goes so many places and tries to juggle so many characters.
There's a lot going on.
I thought, and it might be too much, but a really fun drinking game is to drink every time they introduce a new character because you'll get alcohol poisoning and then die. But everybody in this movie is a character actor that you recognize in tons of other movies.
That's the thing. John Hurd's probably the only person who's not a character actor, but every single person is a character actor playing their role as a character actor.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Even
only room for like one or two.
There are a bunch of notable. John Goodman.
Yes.
Appears in the movie for 2.5 minutes as a cop. That's another thing. It's New York in the 80s, but it's very white. It's very, very white, this movie.
And I didn't understand because they're in Soho, essentially.
Yeah.
And I'm a little confused because I didn't think that was exactly the demographic of Soho, especially the East
All
Eastern
white?
Part.
Well,
I don't know.
Their building is kind of crummy. Like, it's the kind of building that back then artists would rent it out. Although there's a mother and child on the first floor, so go figure. But yeah, it's a divey neighborhood. And I think the point is that, when the homeless people go missing, it's a while before anybody actually notices or does anything about it.
But it's very whitewashed into the point when I said, what's Frankie Faison from The Wire is in it. And Darren was like, there's only one black guy in the entire movie.
He must. So that's the irony. There's one black guy. He's wearing a mask. He's part of the NYPD in the sewers, and they sacrifice him pretty quick.
It's just like, what kind of New York is this?
Oh, also side note, they are the NYPD. They are not military. They are not like alien fighters. They have flamethrowers in the subway.
It sounds like the NYPD today.
Right.
I'm sure they have that now.
These days they have land-to-air missiles.
That's right.
They had to start somewhere. So they had flamethrowers.
Perfect. It's the perfect way to like stop crime.
Get back or I'll set you on fire.
All right, NYPD, you got me.
There is such a, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, and I'll call it a naturalistic way of filming this, because there doesn't seem to be an added light in the entire film.
Maybe it's an early Dogma film.
Judd.
Lars von Trier got the idea from this.
That's why it got into the film festival, because they looked at it and they're like, they didn't use a single goddamn light. This is all natural lighting. But so much of it is in the dark. And for God's sakes, the movie takes place in sewers. So,
well, I mean, there is some, you know, unnatural lighting in that the Chud's eyes seem to be literally
glowing.
Like they're, what are the flashlights?
Yeah.
I mean, they're
essentially. And that's how you can tell when they're dead, because the light goes out.
Excellent. They've lost their power source.
So part of the movie plays with, like, urban legend, conspiracy theory mm-hmm. kind of stuff. Like, we don't know what goes down in the sewers.
It's true.
It could be mutants.
Wasting my time here. You guys wouldn't know the truth if it came up and bit you. Now, do you want to talk about this, or should I go discuss this with the newspapers?
So one of the character actors who has one job to do, and that's, like, lend the government conspiracy, they're out to get us, man. You don't know what's going on. And he's a reporter, but not really.
Mm.
I don't know if you remember the crazy guy who tails John Hurd and then tells him that, like, your pictures, my crazy words, we're going to go far.
Yes.
It was. He's a long-haired, he's another character actor that you recognize from a bunch of stuff, but, like, why? Like, they just, it really seemed like they started making this movie and then they just started adding friends and adding New York actors and just didn't stop until the fucking credits rolled.
Oh, you're in town? Oh, I'm also in town. Oh, your friend's in town? I'm making a movie. Come on down to Soho and make this movie with us.
And you won't recognize a film set because there are no lights.
Exactly.
Look for the trucks and the Chuds. The makeup on the Chuds. We could talk about that for a second. There was one full body Chud.
Uh-huh. Yep.
But I think there was only that one. No, I guess we saw them in the sewer doing a sort of party dance.
Yes.
That was peculiar.
It's a frenzy, I suppose.
It was, they were in a circle. It was almost like AA for Chuds. Like they were just kind of moaning amongst themselves. Daniel Stern is not really delicate about, like, you... Whenever in a horror movie someone is meant to be tiptoeing and you see, like, rocks in their path, I don't know what it is about tense moments where you stop noticing. Okay, you know what? That's a telltale thing. Hmm. If you live in the city, you're walking in the subway or sewers, you're looking where you're stepping.
Absolutely.
Because there's gonna be shit.
Yes.
So I don't buy that. You know what? I'm calling bullshit.
I quit looking up a long time ago. I only look right in front of my feet.
Yeah. But so I'm calling shenanigans on Daniel Stern knocking stuff over when he's trying to, like, get a closer look at the dance, the Chud dance. The Chud's makeup. I kind of like the design of it. I think the glowing eyes is a little ridiculous, but so is the movie.
Sure.
But I kind of like the melty face, bitey mouth, small bitey mouth.
I mean, I'm all for a good mutant that lives in the tunnels of the subway system, because that's all I want to happen in real life. I look out the window when I'm on the train and it's really dark out there, and I, like, look hoping that maybe there'll be a mutant.
But you'd have a heart attack if one, like, put his hand against the window.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Their hands feature big because they... It's a very disciplined movie. They only show hands coming through doors.
Yes.
And occasionally it's a jump cut to a face.
Well, you know, hands, like thumbs, are what separates us from animals. So you need to know that your enemy has the ability to turn doorknobs.
It is a humanoid figure.
Exactly.
I guess it would have to be humanoid to be cannibalistic. Otherwise, it's just predatory.
There's every indication this once was human. It's dressed in the rags of a Bowery bum.
Didn't realize until just now that's, like, misnomer, because they're not eating other Chuds.
Right. That's right.
Because I like to imagine there's a whole species of new people living under the subways that have been, like, breeding there for years.
That's creepy. Like The Descent. They just kind of evolved in the space.
This is what I think about when I'm riding the train, because I don't want to look around.
Thinking about, hoping about.
It'd be like you cutting your toenails and feeding you to a Chud for sure.
One couldn't call this a timeless movie. It's kind of trapped in 1984.
But then parts of me, with the way the NYPD reacts to shit in this movie, I think to myself,
blase,
nothing's
to say the least.
Changed.
Oh, no.
And
this is also...
They're willing to blow up the entire southern half of Manhattan. No problems.
We can't wait any longer. We have to start pumping gas.
What about the subways? What about the power lines?
Stop the subways, we'll kill every power line under the city.
Yeah. Why not? I mean, you've killed everybody here. All these people are dead because of you, Wilson.
We talked about this earlier. They hadn't really thought out the plan that you flood the sewers with gas, and then when you're done, you stop, and then you put the trains back in those tunnels, and everybody knows that they spark up like madmen. So,
or I use my stove, which is not true. I don't cook, but if I did, I would blow up.
Yeah, so no accountings for the mole. And they're pretty callous about that. I feel bad for the underground, the subway-dwelling tunnel homeless people. Although this movie's not even that sensitive to them either, because they're generally portrayed as sociopaths. Yeah, this is a random one, but the Fed, the guy who's like, he's following Daniel Stern eventually. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember this, but when Daniel Stern leaves the city hall meeting with his boot,
yes,
and photographs, and then he goes to the nearest payphone, at which point the Fed takes his 10 cents that he used to assume call the press.
Which I love, 10 cents to make a phone call. And payphones in general is hilarious.
So this Fed, who's plainclothes dressed, but looks like a polo-wearing douche, takes his dime and eats it in front of
him. We've talked before about why we don't put money in our mouths. I think we've gone over this.
I get it. You're meant to be... an anonymous badass.
Right.
But who eats a dime? And
I
then he gets in his
throw
face.
Throw it down a grate like an asshole like that.
Yeah, or put it in your pocket. What's Daniel Stern going to do? He weighs 90 pounds.
Yeah.
But that was the strangest touch. Anyway, so that's the feds for you. Stealing your dimes, eating them. That's illegal. You probably can't eat money. That's like defacing government property.
Destroying it, sort of.
Temporarily. I mean, yeah, defacing it definitely when you poop it, when you poop it out. Poop joke always gets Mindy.
But did it make you want to visit New York City?
About as much as the movie The Warriors did, which is to say, like, during the daytime, yes, but when the sun sets, flee. But yeah, thankfully New York doesn't quite look or feel that way anymore. Maybe some neighborhoods these days.
Very few anymore.
Yeah. So that was Chud, 1984's award-winning Chud.
Yes. Best fantasy film, Brussels International.
So yeah, so try the drinking game where you drink every time they introduce a new character. Yeah, that will be fun. Tell us about it if you survive it.
Don't come and haunt us if you don't.
Keeping to the underground theme, and I guess some stuff does come up in Chud in terms of the subways and the mole people, but let's talk about the subway specifically. The subways are maybe the last vestige of old New York in terms of like whatever gritty 1970s, 1980s New York, it's still down there.
I think as soon as you go underground, you lose your humanity.
I thought you were going to say 30 years, but yeah.
Your humanity. Act like a monster underground. As soon as you don't see sunlight outside anymore, you can just push and shove and clip your toenails, do whatever you want to do.
I always thought of it's like Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. It's Barter Town down there in the subway. But so a little bit of history. The New York subway system is over 100 years old, and covers 660 miles of tracks, 468 stations, most of which were built in 1940. You couldn't really say they've aged well.
No, they have not aged well. People have put paint on top of it. which I love seeing when the paint starts to crumble down. You can see all the layers since 1940.
Rainbow of history at this point, load-bearing paint.
Yes. It's terrifying.
So for a time during the 70s and 80s, the 4 train was considered the worst in the entire New York subway system, and it was referred to as the Muggers Express.
That's insane, because remember, now we took that office poll, which train would you want to die on, and we chose 4 or 5.
Because
it's the nicest. It's
relatively clean. It's very clean, and seemingly attracts considerate commuters.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mentioned the average weekday subway ridership is 5.6 million people, and that counts you and I amongst them.
I think they're all on one car in my train.
That idea of just drawing insanity, and there's something to the idea that like people aren't meant to be shoulder to shoulder for long. It is unhealthy, and it kind of generates like an air of inhumanity.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying.
So... there are 2 stories that specifically I jumped out at me, and these are recent history. In 2006, a mentally unstable man found an electric saw on the one train on the 110th Street station and attacked a postal worker on the platform.
He found the saw.
They were doing work down there.
Oh, and they left who leaves a saw?
I think it was a sawzall that they left unattended, and this dude took it. Let's see. A man waving two power saws.
Oh, why not?
Dual wielding 2 power saws he grabbed from a table being used by electricians in the subway, sliced into the chest of a postal worker on a platform in Manhattan early yesterday, puncturing the man's lung. The suspect, whom the police identified as so-and-so, was arrested after he punched another man 2 hours later on the street. He got away with the sawing the postal worker.
Then why? Oh, I guess he was maybe away from his electrical outlet, because I'm not going to punch if I have a saw.
Maybe they were plugged in. He couldn't take them with
him. He could only go so far. So you knew you could have evaded this guy if you would have just gotten out of the length of the cord.
Right, the range. Okay, we can laugh because the guy survived.
Yeah,
thank goodness.
But it's not funny.
So that attack came just 3 weeks after a 13-hour rampage during which 4 random victims were stabbed in Manhattan. That was 2006, and at first I thought that was referring to Maxim Gelman. Do you remember him from The Killer Speaks?
Yes, I do.
So there's an interview series, The Killer Speaks, a bunch of which are on Netflix, and this guy was a big fan of PCP, and it seemingly got away from him.
He got a little stabby.
And so he had a showdown on the 3 train, incidentally, my commuting morning route. He had killed his girlfriend, I think his mother and stepfather, and a guy just on the street he drove over.
Yes, the old man.
Did he kill his girlfriend's mother? I thought he might have.
I don't remember, because I remember the girlfriend, the sad, I mean, the whole thing is terrifying and sad, but the girlfriend wasn't there at first.
Right.
And
he had delusions, also calling her the girlfriend was never really
right,
the case.
Right, exactly. And it was a really a bad situation of wrong place at the wrong time with almost every single one of his victims.
Yeah.
Because even the old man crossing the street that he hits, just guy crossing the street.
Yeah. So he winds up on day 2 on the 3 train. He is on the cover of the New York Post. People are reading the paper, and he's sitting across going, "That's me. That's me. They're after me." And he's still wielding the knife that he killed the girlfriend with. When he knocks on the train conductor's door, like he's I don't know, he wants to kill a cop or a conductor in this case. He knocks on the door of the subway conductor's car, and there happens to be a cop inside.
Right.
And so that cop opens the door, sees him, and then closes the door.
Yep. He says, "Oh, I don't want to fuck with this."
No, it's just like, "Hey, you other commuters, you deal with this."
Exactly.
The guy turns around. At this point, he's caught the attention of a Good Samaritan, a big guy, thankfully. So this big guy recognizes that this is the sociopath from the news and the paper, and he's got a knife, and he's wielding it. So this big guy tackles him, doesn't do a great job. So Maxim starts stabbing the dude
in
the back of the head.
Yeah.
And the guy gets him down to the ground and is struggling, at which point the train pulls into the station and cops are waiting for him. If memory serves, the cops see this all happening. Dude's getting stabbed in the back of the head. They don't intervene. They don't physically remove him until stabbing victim manages to get the knife away from him and like knocks him.
That single guy did the job of about 20 police at that time.
And the cops watched it all.
Yeah.
The cops watched it all happen. It's heartbreaking. I mean, the guy survived. The victim survived that time, but he did sue the city rightfully.
Well, shit. You don't, like, if you're a cop, you don't see a threat and close the door.
Yeah, that was pretty fucked up.
That's really fucked up.
That cop in court said that she suspected that Maxim had a gun. Still, you left a gun-wielding sociopath.
Citizens. Your job is to protect the citizens. You close the fucking door. Let's be serious.
Yeah. So that happened on the train. In terms of other sociopaths on the train, we're going to talk about Midnight Meat Train.
Yay!
Both the short story and the movie. More so the short story.
Right, because I don't understand. In the movie, it's not particularly New York.
Right. They never say where it is, although there's some iconic L.A., like the diner from Seven and every other movie uses this one.
It just kind of was disappointing because in the book is such a hate letter, love letter to New York City.
Okay.
It's about a guy, you know, the main character has just moved to New York 3 months ago. And you know how I said earlier, like, you get it within 6 months or you get the fuck out.
Learning curve, yeah.
And he has not. He's already out of love with New York. So that's not good in 3 months. It usually takes you about like 7 years to get like fed up with New York, but then you don't know anything better and you're stuck. That's the history of
And that's why people are cranky here.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, Kaufman's only been, the main character's only been there for about 3 months. And so that's the thing. It's all about his kind of loathing for New York. And then you pair that with the butcher, who is Mahogany.
Yeah. Great name.
Who is just loathing of everything, kind of. He's just a guy who goes to work. He has a family, but he's got to do this job, which is murder the people on the train.
Right. He's feeding.
He is feeding
creatures at the end of the
exactly.
line.
Exactly. He is feeding what runs the city, which are these old monster creatures and a big giant monster creature that also lives under there. Yeah, so there's a reason. And so he's a very thorough killer, which he's an excellent character because he's just a over 55-year-old man that has a job to do. And he goes on the train, he picks off the best specimens and butchers them.
Yeah, and Kaufman falls asleep on the train. In the movie, they turn him into the very handsome Bradley Cooper. But in the far more realistic is Kaufman, who's, I don't know, just a schlubby, sleepy guy.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's kind of that's the terrifying element to me, that I've fallen asleep on the train plenty.
But see, that's I even put that as a lesson. There's a lesson in Midnight Meat Train. The lesson is don't fall asleep on the train.
Okay. I can't promise I'm not going to do that more.
You will end up at the end of the line and you'll be fed to a giant old person.
So the movie, I had forgotten, I refreshed, but it's got a bunch of people that you recognize. Mm-hmm. Leslie Bibb, Brooke Shields, Bradley Cooper, and Vinnie Jones plays Mahogany, which is maybe the best thing about the movie.
Vinnie Jones, anytime he shows up in a movie, I'm in love. I love Vinnie Jones. I want him to be in next season of Walking Dead.
That would be dope. Yeah, no, if Vinnie Jones were to play Negan, that would be
in my head, that's who I see.
Show.
That's what I see. But for Mahogany, not so much.
He only says one word at the end of the movie, but I think he's really just, I don't know, he's such an ominous presence. I really like that.
But Mahogany's not supposed to be. He's just supposed to be a regular middle-aged man. Mm. So the fact that, I mean, Vinnie Jones doesn't walk into a room. Vinnie Jones walks into a room, I think he commands that room.
Yeah,
and that's not Mahogany. So it was kind of, I mean, it's great to see Vinnie Jones anytime I get to see him, but it was kind of disappointing because I love the short story so much.
Mm. And it's in the first volume of the Books of Blood.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which has come up a lot on this podcast.
Yeah, because I love it. And that particular story is so good. And I mean, the movie was fine, but New York is such a central part of that book because these monsters feed New York. And if you know New York, you know it's like gritty and it's dirty and it's believable that there could be some ancient monsters underground running this shit.
Right, the sort of weird energy under everything.
Exactly.
That sort of maintains the tempo of the city.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. Midnight Meat Train. It's a decent movie. It's got very little to do with New York. There's a weird obsession in the movie with eyes popping out of heads.
Yes.
Do you remember that? It happens on at least two different occasions because Mahogany uses a hammer, which I'm guessing in the book he doesn't because it's not really an effective means.
No, he doesn't use it. He has a cleaver.
Okay. Yeah. In this one, they give him a meat tenderizer and it's kind of leaning into the meat train dynamic. But he hits two different people and I don't think it actually works that way that you could hit someone really hard and their eyes wouldn't pop out of their skull.
I don't know what that's about. I know there's a scene in the book where one of the monster guys takes someone's eye out, but they're already dead and they're just eating it for fun.
Yeah. This one is done like it was meant to be a 3D movie and he wants the eyes popping out at the audience.
I don't know. Clive Barker, you know, gets like an image in his head and then he overuses it.
Well, he didn't direct it. It was directed by Ryuhei Kitamura, who makes mostly Japanese movies. But yeah, I think even the script wasn't Clive Barker adapting it. Before this gets any worse, I did want to sort of give almost a disclaimer. Like, we are talking pretty negatively about the city. I think because it's horror, the tendency is to like lean dark.
Well, it's like talking about your own family. Like, you can like think like, oh man, what a loser my brother is or something. But if someone else calls your brother a loser, then you're like, get the fuck out of here.
Those are fighting words.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I do feel like we do have to remind people that New York is actually one of the safest big cities in the world.
It's true.
I feel like, you know, in movies, New York is either portrayed as dark and dangerous or a magical setting for romantic comedy. And so the reality is somewhere in the middle. New York has actually evolved pretty substantially in the last 35 years. Mm-hmm. It's funny to think, like when I was growing up, all my family's from New York. I grew up in New Jersey. But when you referred to like 42nd Street, it was synonymous with like prostitution and drugs.
Right, right, right.
And that was only 35 years ago. These days, it's way more the M&M store and Disney musicals on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
So don't let this podcast stop you from visiting. If anything, you know, find the gritty corners and enjoy by all means. So when people talk about that moment where they realize they were a New Yorker, they ask like, when did you realize you were a New Yorker? I always joke that it's the point where you look at rats on the subway the same as you do squirrels on the street.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Sometimes they can be cute. Like, I saw a rat running down the subway tracks with a piece of, it was like a wrapper for a candy bar.
Yeah.
It was like an ad, and I thought to myself, that would be the cutest ad.
It's a moving
He's
ad.
He's like a little billboard running down the tracks.
Eat Snickers. Rats love them.
Exactly.
What are you, too good for rats? Comedian Shang Wang told this joke after moving to New York and getting used to the visual of rats everywhere. He said, I realize I have an irrational fear of rats. I did not know there was going to be so much wildlife in this city.
Yeah.
One night I was walking home really late. I walked past this huge pile of garbage, and inside one particular trash bag was a whole lot of movement going on inside the bag, like real aggressive, but unidentified rustling. I was so frightened. My only thought was, oh my God, I hope that's a baby.
That's terrible.
So your husband had a rat encounter, which might be one of my favorite stories.
Yeah, it was the tale of meeting the king of the rats. When we lived in Murray Hill, another thing about New York is that it's always under construction. On every block, there's a scaffolding. There's a particular building we used to live by that is still under construction. It has been under construction since before we moved there in 2007. It is still under construction. So this has been, I don't know how many, 8 years. It's still under construction. No hopes of ever finishing. But what it does is create these little tunnels, which I like to refer to as rape tunnels, because it's perfect for the raping. And so I avoid, as a lady, avoid rape tunnels. My husband, apparently not so afraid of rape, goes right in for it. Or maybe inviting it.
Faces rape head on.
And one night he was coming home late, and he comes into the house and he tells me the story of meeting the king of the rats.
And he's walking down. It's completely dark. The only thing that's out are our neighborhood bums, which is another thing about New York. You know who everyone is. The guy who lives on your stoop.
Yeah, they become familiar
faces. The guy who's passed
faces.
Out over here, sure. And you're used to that. He's stepping around the local homeless flora and fauna. And he comes upon the rape tunnel. The rape tunnel is well lit. He walks through the rape tunnel about halfway and encounters the king of the rats, who runs right out into the middle of the sidewalk.
Boss rat.
The middle of the tunnel. He says it's the biggest rat he's ever seen. He might be exaggerating, but he says it's the size of a possum. Okay, it's
holy
like
shit.
He tells the story. The rat gets bigger, I think, through the years. The rat sits up. He stops right in front of him, the rat. And Jackson, my husband, considers the rat for a second, thinking that he'll stomp his feet, the rat will go on its way.
Sure.
This is clearly the order of things, being a human on the top of the chain.
So we thought.
So he thought. He stomps his foot, the rat stands up on his hind legs. You know how they do that.
Yeah, like a bear.
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to intimidate.
Like a teeny tiny bear. And it was enough, though. Even though, I mean, this rat's maybe like a foot tall or something. It was enough that it turns my husband around. He walks back out of the rape tunnel and crosses the street and continues on his way.
He was like a bully forcing Jackson to take a different route home.
And the king of the rats like owns that area.
Wow.
He runs Barter Town for sure.
So rats, and this was this next one you wanted me to see.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm grateful. Like, it's just another flavor of movie making. But Mulberry Street.
Yes.
Directed by Jim Mickle, uh-huh. who also directed the vampire movie Stakeland.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of enjoy that he's a jack of all trades. We could firmly put him in the, like, indie filmmaker
Absolutely.
Sort of. Same as someone like Robert Rodriguez. He's mm-hmm. a Renaissance man in the way that he... In addition to doing the directing and acting, he also edited the movie, he did sound, and also special effects.
Yeah, yeah.
So this you brought to my attention because it was one of the 8 movies to die for?
Yeah, part of the After Dark Horror Fest.
Okay.
And it used to be at a time, it's not like that anymore, but it used to be these guys were cranking out, After Dark Horror Fest and After Dark Films was cranking out some of the best horror for the last, like, in about a succession of about 7 years. Mm. Every year you'd have 8 films to die for, and they were the 8 best horror films. And I think, in my opinion, they were the best non-mainstream horror, 8 okay. best films of the year.
Yeah, and it was definitely a launching platform for Jim Mickle. So I'll say it was very indie looking.
Mm-hmm.
It was digitally shot, and that's really unforgiving in darkly set scenes where it gets really gritty. It gets
yeah.
like the digital pixelation.
It's very dark. I mean, the whole thing was made for $60,000.
Yeah, so it yeah, you got to forgive a certain amount for that. I did feel like it was a little over-edited. Like it's sort of, they did a lot of work to not have a single visual on screen very long because they weren't great looking. I will say it was authentic as fuck in mm-hmm. terms of actually showing what a real New York apartment is, but in this case, Mulberry Street is the very last vestige of Little Italy
right.
in the city because it's sort of sandwiched by Chinatown on all sides. And so there's a subplot of gentrification
right.
and rent increases and a buyout from a real estate broker, although they don't really go much into that storyline. It just kind of, it serves as like, these characters are uncomfortable from the start, and this is why, and then it only gets worse.
That's kind of New York, though.
Yeah, I thought...
You're uncomfortable all the time, almost all the time.
It doesn't come up in movies enough. You could have a horror movie that's just straight up real estate these days. It would
exactly.
just be like, these people are priced out of their apartments. Poor New York, and I've really appreciated that, like, they were resourceful in using a bunch of exterior shots. I couldn't really tell whether it was, like, protests or parades, but moments where cops were shepherding people around certain spaces.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, you reframe that, and there's an outbreak, and
right.
people are sort of, you know, being kept off the streets. And that's kind of what the movie does. They do a lot of, like, fake... TV footage, man on the scene kind
mm-hmm.
of things. And it wasn't, it was a little amateurish, but
it's an NY, it's it a, he was well, an NYU student. It's a film, you know, a student film.
Oh, at
film.
The time, do you think?
Well, that's how they meet. So, I mean, that's how Jim Mickle meets Domenici. But, I think you always come from that background, though, student filmmaking. You only had $60,000. What are you going to do?
Yeah, it certainly breeds resourcefulness. So, talking to the premise of the movie, it's as close as we'll get to like a good modern zombie movie, mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. case, Fast Zombies, but it is sort of rat transmitted mm-hmm. off the bat, and then it becomes human transmitted. And I won't tangent too much, but it actually had a lot in common with Zombievers.
It does, actually. I was thinking about it as I was writing notes for this movie, and we had just talked about...
It'll come out, yeah, soon.
Okay, so we had just talked about Zombievers, and I thought to myself, Darren's going to think I'm obsessed with people turning me
into rodent into people. Rodents.
Like, I have a really big problem.
Well, that said, yeah, no, our review on Zombievers is coming up soon. Well, there were a couple ridiculous moments. They weren't supposed to be ridiculous. They just happened that way. So our main character, Clutch, mm-hmm. who...
It's the Domenici guy. Yeah. He's one of the writers.
He's a former boxer. He does a lot of shadow boxing, yeah. in the movie. And like he's still training, like the fight's coming up, but not going to happen. But in any case, so when they're fleeing and there is a rat person outside, this happens in the bar. He hits the rat guy with a baseball bat. Sure. Doesn't seem to have the impact he was going for. So he drops the bat and he just decides it's put up your dukes time, and that's going to be his most effective means.
Because if the bat didn't do it, your fist will.
Yeah, his lethal weapons, his hands. And he goes on to punch in the skull of the rat.
Which is, it's always like a huge thing that bothers me in zombie films, like, don't cut your hands up, dude.
Yeah.
Don't cut your hands up.
No.
Don't be stupid. Yeah. Wear a mask. Close your eyes.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have that much prep. Although he does tape up his hands like he's going out boxing before he, perfect. You know, encounters. He's planning on running into rat zombies. The other kind of ridiculous thing, and I really do have to call bullshit because, okay. Later in the movie, an old veteran guy mm-hmm. explodes his oxygen tank with a lighter.
Which is bullshit because I've seen people smoke with oxygen tanks.
Now, I'm no scientician or rocket surgeon, but air doesn't explode. I mean, if you rupture the tank, it is a combustible thing in term. Combustible is the wrong word. Like, it could.
Don't use those scientician words around me.
So what I'm saying is the old man wasn't getting propane into his lungs. It wasn't butane he was sniffing. So the idea that he just put a lighter in front of an oxygen tank was bananas. And that was just like, wow, that doesn't make any sense. Like, if you wanted to hit it with a tack hammer, maybe, and rupture it, then maybe something. But just air and fire, it would just blow out the lighter.
There was a lot of taking yourself out in that movie as well.
Yeah, there was.
There was a whole lot of that.
Yeah. I don't know. Okay, so all in all, I enjoyed the like bare bones indie filmmaking approach to this mm-hmm. movie, but it wasn't a very good movie.
But I think it's like, so it's very New York because I thought it was really a real situation. You have these neighbors that are bizarre. You know, I mean, everyone's like a character.
They get
here.
Along surprisingly well.
They actually do. They really do. I mean, the movie's like based around bitching about two of the most like things that New Yorkers bitch about all the time. How hot it is.
And rent.
And
yeah.
rats.
Oh, rats. I okay.
Oh, and rent.
Rat. Rent, rat. Three things.
Three things. Because that's pretty much all I complain about. And being poor. I would add that to the list.
Yeah.
If you're a New Yorker, you only talk about those items.
That's the weather for us. It's, yeah. Okay, so those were a couple of New York movies. I think in the future we'll return to the subject matter. A couple.
There's a lot.
Yeah, a couple New York movies specifically that jumped out at me that we might cover in the future was the original Maniac.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good, but it does have Tom Savini's handiwork.
Yay!
The unofficial, not really sequel to Night of the Living Dead by Lucio Fulci, Zombie.
Uh-huh.
That's a New York one. and Rosemary's Baby, which should probably get its own episode with Roman Polanski's Repulsion.
And I would throw in there Cropsey, the documentary about Staten Island mental health place, just similar to Roosevelt Island.
Yeah, I was thinking about that while you were describing the hospitals on Roosevelt.
Because that's a real life horror.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we could do a series of documentaries. We'll figure it out. and if you, the listener, have some specific movies in mind, get us on Twitter at Rans Macabre and let us know what kind of stuff we might have missed.
Yeah.
So on a final note, I think there's no getting around it. As much as we bitch and moan, like, New York is a city to love. And I was thinking about it in terms of having the most diverse population, having like wild foods you couldn't mm-hmm. have imagined as a child, and all these things are up late at night. Like, it doesn't work that way in a utopia. You can't put all these different cultures shoulder to shoulder and expect them to get along perfectly.
Right. It doesn't work like that.
So New York does kind of give you the good with the bad, but the good is pretty great.
It is pretty great. The fact that I can eat anything I want at 2 o'clock in the morning is top notch.
And the movies ain't bad either. So, I don't know. Come for the food, stay for the movies.
That's terrible.
All right, I'll edit that part out.
Come for the food, stay for the rats.
maybe I won't edit that part out. But, okay, so that's our episode on New York horror from two, adopted New Yorkers.
Yep.
So this, as always, you can find us on Stitcher and iTunes and at Rans Macabre on Twitter. This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.
It's up to you, New York.